Okay, Erev Tov, everybody, or Boker Tov for those living in Israel, Lori, and really thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. The other day, as we have our concluding panel for the 13th annual International Conference on Jewish Medical Ethics, and pleasure to see everybody. And I'm just going to briefly introduce our panelists. I'll do it in alphabetical order. Rabbi Mark Drach is the Executive Vice President of the Rabbinical Council of America, a role he's had, I won't call it a job, since 2012. Rabbi Drach is the founder of JSAFE, the Jewish Institute to Support an Abuse-Free Environment. He taught at Yeshiva University, Isaac Breuer College, and have served as a pulpit rabbi for 22 years. And of course, those in Toronto remember him for the rabbi of Sher Shemaim here in Toronto. Lori Novick is a Yoetzet Halacha, director and head writer of Diracheha, project of Yeshivat Haaretzion. They have a wonderful website dealing with all kinds of issues and women and halacha. She has taught many classes for Torah in Motion, really wonderful classes. She's been working as a Yoetzet for many, many years, has a master's degree in Talmud from Bar Ilan University, and Bible and Jewish education from YU, and a BA from Yale University. I put them in hierarchical order. Okay, Dr. Rivka Gepres-Schwartz is the Associate Principal of General Studies and Director of Machon Siach at SAR High School in the Bronx and a Research Fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute. She earned her PhD in History of Science from Princeton University, and she writes and lectures widely about issues in contemporary Orthodoxy. Rabbi Shlomo Weisman is director of the Beit Din of America and the adjunct professor of the Sy Sim School of Business at Yeshiva University. He has Yadin Yadin Smicha, a graduate of Columbia Law School. He worked for a number of years on Wall Street. And if I may say, his Toronto connection is he married a Toronto girl who grew up a few blocks away from where I live. And a pleasure to welcome all of you. Thank you very much. Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to start, and maybe Dr. Schwartz, I'll begin with you, if I may. I'd like to ask you, the pandemic has created many new technologies for learning. I know SAR was really the first school. I know I teach at CHAT, and I think CHAT consulted with the team at SAR, putting together, how we're going to teach over Zoom and through the pandemic. Can you discuss how some of these new technologies may continue, what we can learn from them, what can be implemented, and the downfalls, the pluses? Bakasha.
Thank you so much. I'll start by saying that the first thing that we learned about new technologies in the pandemic is that they are not going to replace in-person education. So if we thought that this was the magic bullet, for the tuition crisis, we're going to move all of our schools online and virtual. And I think for about the first 2 minutes of Zoom learning, people said, oh, this is great. This is neat, maybe. And then as it dragged on week after week and month after month, the ways in which Zoom learning is better than no learning, but it's not a substitute for in-person education, became very clear. Having said that, there are all kinds of new technologies that we were forced to exploit last year and are now thinking about how we can exploit in productive and meaningful ways moving forward. So while we clearly are not eager to move all of our programming onto Zoom, a lot of the programming and education that we do for parents, which we struggled all the time with, we do these great adult ed programs, or we do these great parenting programs, or we do these great how to keep your kids safe from substances programs, and the turnout is not what we would hope for, we found that when we moved them onto Zoom, turnout was actually much better. The most popular thing that we did on Zoom was parent-teacher conferences. Instead of parents having to drive to school and find parking in school and run around the gym spending 5 minutes talking to each one of their kids' 10 teachers, the ability to do that on Zoom was such an unmixed blessing for both teachers and students that we're continuing that. So in the realm of technology and its basic applications, remote learning, the first thing that we learned is that being in person together with other human beings really, really matters. The second thing we learned is that this is still a technology that has its uses. Parents is one, Something else that's not making us beloved of our students is the recognition that snow days don't have to be snow days. They can be snow days if we feel like that's a thing to do. Last year, we said one snow day and then we learned on Zoom. We're trying to get away with doing that again this year so that we keep the zecher of what a snow day was. But then after that, we can come back together and learn. So that's, you know, having said all of that, I will say that there are places and avenues where we found that our kids' education was very much enriched by opening up our thinking about the possibilities of remote learning, not in the classroom. The teacher-student interaction, the student-student interaction in the classroom is essential. But I had a student reach out to me this year from Fuchs Beit Sefer Mizrahi, which is a modern Orthodox high school in Cleveland, Ohio. She organized a student club, a Orthodox feminism club, and she's been inviting women from all over the country to speak to her students, to speak to her classmates. And would I come join them for a lunch period one day and speak to her classmates? And the answer is, sure, of course I will. Of course I'll come speak to a group of students in Cleveland for 15 minutes during lunch one day about whatever the particular issue was that I came to speak about. My own students, I have two students this year who started an electoral politics and government club and were extremely dedicated and committed far beyond anything that I could bring to being their faculty advisor. And so when there was a special election for the New York City Council in our district, in the district that SAR High School is sitting in, they told me they wanted to run a Zoom forum for the candidates. I said, go for it, try it out, why not? And we ended up hosting a Zoom forum for all of the candidates in the city council special election who participated in a Zoom forum hosted by SAR High School students that they wouldn't have, I don't think, if we actually asked them to come into school. So then my kid said to me, well, now we want to do it for the mayor's race in New York City. I said, you're crazy. Mayoral candidates in New York City are not coming to a bunch of yeshiva high school kids hosting a Zoom debate, but sure, go for it. Why not try? The upshot was by the time these kids were done, they had turned that into an interfaith youth mayoral forum. They had connected themselves to Catholic school students, to Muslim community groups in New York, to an interfaith center in New York. My students hosted a mayoral debate online that most of the leading candidates, including the person who seems to have emerged as the Democratic nominee and therefore the almost certain to be elected next mayor of New York, Eric Adams, participated in, none of which would have been possible without Zoom. And so that is all to say, I think what I'm saying, and I'll close with this, is the core functions of education have to happen in person. They have to happen together. They have to happen with people in the room. And if we hope that Zoom was going to supplant that, and if we hope that Zoom was going to make that cheaper, Zoom is not doing it. What it does is it increases our reach in a number of ways. So it lets us engage with parents or other members of the school community who might have found it difficult to come into the building, but we're discovering they're actually interested in what we're offering. And it has afforded our students the ability to extend their reach in terms of whom they learn from, whom they connect to, whom they invite into the building to speak.
Thank you. Rabbi Drash, before I ask you about shuls, maybe I ask you to comment on that. What about as the executive vice president of the RCA, we have many issues. I'm, of course, a member of the RCA, many issues up for debate. We have yet to have a Zoom meeting, really, of the, you know, rabbis to even, I don't know how you conduct the executive meetings, but maybe some of the contentious issues that we face, we should have an open forum, have three, four people, if you want to comment on that.
Oh, thank you very much. Let's move on.
No, I'm not letting you move on.
No, the truth is Zoom has enabled us, and that's something I wanted to touch on actually with the question that I will discuss that you will ask. But Zoom has enabled us to have conversations with people throughout the country, and there's a lot of advantage to that. If you look at the structure, for example, of our leader, of our officers now, or of our executive committee, what used to be a very New York-centric organization is now a national and international organization. We have people who attend our meetings, whether it's an executive committee meeting with 50 or 60 members or officers meetings, whatever, from all over the world that can come together and that can talk, and that connects us. The downside, as Dr. Press Schwartz was mentioning, is you lose a certain sense of intimacy and human contact. And so, for example, as a young rabbi, I would attend meetings in the RCA office in New York and not only got to know, but befriended and developed very strong relationships with other rabbis in the area. Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, Zichrono Livracha, for example, the past president of the RCA, recently passed away, and a number of other people who I would meet at meetings on a monthly or bi-monthly basis, and we developed a relationship that doesn't happen on Zoom to the same degree. So we are able to have conversations where we are able to share. And at the same time, it does create a certain sense of distance and lack of intimacy, which we suffer from.
Lori, you want to comment on that?
Sure. So just primarily as a mother, but also as an educator, two things that I really have seen happening through the Zoom and education that I think will stick around is, number one, the options for defining community in a different way. I think both Dr. Schwartz and Rabbi Drach touched on this, but I think it's important on the micro level and not just on the macro level that teachers and students or groups of students can associate in all different types of configurations with a whole other level of ease than you would have in person. And that I think has been very, very beneficial. It's been very, very beneficial as me as a teacher based in Israel who had travel plans before the pandemic happened, like I'm sure so many of you did. I've been able to reach communities all over the world, you know, and that's and to create all different types of learning frameworks that couldn't possibly have existed before. One other thing as a parent that I've seen in particular with my children is a different level of independence that they've developed because of the use of learning technologies. The term for the kids now is digital natives, as opposed to many of us here on this call who have come to digital methods of learning a little later in life. So thanks to Rabbi Jay, I'm much better at Zoom than I was a year ago. And because our children are so capable and confident with these new platforms, often in a way that far exceeds their teachers, certainly their parents, I think the students have been put much more firmly in the driving seat of their own education. What I saw during the pandemic was the level in which I was on top of what my kids were doing when, or even their teachers were, and the level in which they took their own responsibility for managing a number of different things happen at once. That was really, I think, a bracha that I'm hoping we'll be able to retain after the pandemic. The kids using these new platforms that they're so expert in to really take, to some degree, to take control of their own education.
Rabbi Wiseman, have you managed to conduct any court cases on Zoom?
Yeah, we've been really successful in doing so. There are some things that rabbinical courts can't do over Zoom. You can't do a get over Zoom, no matter how hard you try. But Zoom has been absolutely spectacular as a forum, as a platform for running Dinei Torah, for arbitrating disputes. And it's allowed us slowly, this is just starting, but I see the trend beginning, allowed us to really spread our wings and spread the geographic reach that we could resolve disputes over. You know, there's a prohibition in the Torah to go to secular court. You have to bring your disputes to Beit Din. And it's always been a real challenge for people who don't have access, where, you know, not living in the New York area, don't have access on a simple level to the resources, to the expertise of high-level Batei Din, rabbinical courts. How do you tap into that? What do you do when you have a dispute? Do you just go to your local rabbi who might not know elements of secular law, might not know the norms of business practices? But with technologies like Zoom, we're now able to kind of cater to a much, much wider geographic area. And it's been absolutely incredible in terms of our ability to hear cases from across a much wider geographic area and to service a wider population of people. So Zoom has really worked well for us.
So there's been a major increase in cases you're hearing, people who wouldn't have gone to Beit Din, do you think there are people who would have gone to a secular court, and now that Beit Din's available, are taking advantage of that?
I think so. Our numbers are up. Our Din Torah numbers are up. I think that's in part because of the ease of Zoom. And I think it's a trend that's really just starting. We need to kind of think of ways of marketing ourselves, letting more and more people know about the fact that you could do a Din Torah over Zoom. Now, obviously, there are downsides as well. When people are in a room, it might be easier to take testimony. It might be easier for the litigants, for the lawyers to present to the panel, to feel that they're being heard. It's a more natural process. There's also halachic implications. You know, one of the features of a Din Torah, of appearing in front of a Beit Din, is the aspect of Elokim Nitzav Be'adas Kel, this idea that the Shechina resides when a Beis Din sits and hears a case. It's not clear to us yet what the Shechina thinks of Zoom. But on a very basic level, it probably doesn't reside over Zoom. You probably need to be there in person. So you lose out on something. But that said, on a very practical level, we found that we've been able to, you know, really get the facts, hear the arguments well over Zoom. It's been a clear enough and a intimate enough forum for Dayanim to really feel that they're able to hear and judge a case just as well as in person, I think.
Kvodo male olam. I think it's Zoom and all the digital platforms. We feel closer, you know. Rabbi Drach, we'll get back to what I wanted to ask you on shuls. You know, I've not stepped foot inside a shul in 17 months. We went to Minyan, backyard Minyan, and as the head of, you know, well over 1,000 rabbis, and the majority of the public rabbis in North America, what can you do to bring people and back to shul? And what do we do when backyard minyanim say we're more comfortable here, either from a physical, they're still a little nervous, the variants are still around, we're still not quite post-pandemic, please God, we'll get there. And people who have found they've enjoyed the experience much more, even doubling on their own. And what strategies might you recommend to deal with these issues?
All right, thank you. Well, I'll tell you, the beginning of COVID was much, much easier for us at the RCA and for rabbis and shuls than the situation in which we find ourselves now. Because when everyone was in the same situation, it was easy to say close down. And it was easy to say that we have one rule that applies that applies across the board. But as COVID, you know, waxes and wanes and peters out and gets stronger in different places, different communities are in very, very different stages. You're located in Toronto. And Toronto has had a very, very difficult time and still continues to have a difficult time. We here in New York have pretty much put COVID behind us. And our shuls are open and we're not wearing masks in public if we're vaccinated. And it's a whole very, very different, experience. And when rabbis call looking for advice, what should I do? The advice is much more complicated now because I really have to turn it back to them and say, you need to speak to your local authorities and your local medical experts and your local advisors and local public health, because it really is very different in many different places. But all of that being said, we're beginning to see as shuls begin to reopen and things begin to return to normal, the good and the bad. And what I mean by the good is that there is this desire of chadesh yameinu kekedem. You know, let's get things back to the way they were, to get back into the, for many people, to get back into the shul and to get back into the davening the way it was and the programming the way it was, the kiddushes the way they were, et cetera, et cetera. And for others, they say, don't bother me. I was very happy with my backyard minyan. I was happy that the davening didn't last 2.5 hours on a Shabbos morning, and it took us only an hour and a half. I was happy that the rabbi and the officers and the gabayim, you know, wasn't a top down heavy control over what the davening looked like on a Shabbos morning, and it was more democratic in that sense, and more personal. And so, what you wind up with, I think, is this very interesting tension. Within that verse itself, Chadesh Yameinu Kekedem, which struck me as a rather strange combination of terms, because Chadesh means to renew, not just to renew, but to make new, of Chiddush, of something that's new and never seen before. And yet at the same time, it's Kekedem as it once was. So how do you have a situation of returning Kekedem as in days of old, and yet at the same time of Chadesh, of Chidush, of doing something that is new. So I'd like to offer, as a way of kind of structuring my comments, a couple of observations about that tension and about that verse. The first is a very interesting Medrash and Eicha Rabbah. Those words, Chadesh Yameinu Kekedem, renew our days as of old, is found at the end of the book of Eicha of Lamentations, which we will read, next week on Tisha B'Av. And in trying to explain, when we say Kedem, as of old, renew our days as of old, what's the Kedem? What's the of old that we're looking to reestablish? So the gut reaction is we're talking about a time of the existence of the temple and the offering of the korbanot or whatever else it may be. So the Medrash and Eicha Rabbah actually has a different take on it. What does it mean? Chadesh Yomenu Kekedem, says the Medrash, Adam HaRishon. We're talking about the days of Adam. And so you'll think, okay, that's wonderful. Let's be back to the Garden of Eden with pick the fruit except for the apple off the tree. And life is good and we don't have to work. And we're living in it. We're living in the Edenic utopia. But then the verse, the Medrash comes to quote a strange verse. What's the proof text that Chadesh Yamenu Kekedem refers to Adam HaRishon, to the first man? Because the verse says in the third chapter of Bereishit, Vayigaresh et ha'am, that God banished, exiled the man, Vayashkein mikedem legan Eden, and he lived east of Eden. So here we have God, here we have Lamentations, Jeremiah quoting John Steinbeck in a very anachronistic way, but we're referring to the time not of Adam's sojourn in Eden, but rather after the sin and after the banishment when he's living east of Eden. Rather than quoting the verse just the chapter before, Vayitah Hashem Elokim gan be'eden mikedem, because the word kedem is also used when the Garden of Eden was initially planted, we're talking about a time afterwards. And what I think the Medrash there is saying is something that's very important for us. And that is that you're never going to get back to a time of, you know, to the origin. You're never going to be able to go home again to that place of pure paradise. And so to think that even after a pandemic, we're going to go back and look, the shuls weren't eaten, so they weren't perfect before the pandemic. But a year and a half of being home alone and davening for those who have this strong desire to go to shul, it's the good old days of when shuls were busy and active and all those things. That's not the prayer. But it's a way of struggle. What is the proof text of Vayigaresh et Adam Vayashkein Mikedem Legan Eden that we're talking about a time which is post-paradise? It's because following challenges, following difficulties, following the exile, Adam and Eve themselves had to struggle to build their own garden, to build their own home. They had to learn from their past experiences. They had to live with their regrets and with the losses that they had, and then recreate life. Chadesh Yamenu Kekedem means that we need to find new and innovative and creative ways to create a new Eden, a new sense of synagogue, of shul, of congregation, of community that reflects the best of what we had before we were banished, before the pandemic, but that also has a sense of chiddush. And it's very, very important. And to take a couple of things, and just very briefly, what are some of the things that we can and need to take with us that were positive from this experience? So I've never been busier in my work in the RCA than the first year of COVID, because there were thousands of shilas. How do we do? First, it started with Purim, and can we have Megillah reading over Zoom? And then Pesach came with 100,000 different questions, and Shavuos, and the summer, and Rosh Hashanah, and shofar blowing, and there were so many shilas being asked. I mean, many of you are probably familiar. There are books of 700-800 pages that collect rabbinic responses, that collect shuvot to questions that were posed. There was a desire and a longing on the part of individuals to want to keep the halacha and to want to know how to keep the halacha and to know what the law, what Jewish law had to say about everything. And how do I daven at home? And what do I include? And what don't I include? And so many questions besides the medical ethical questions and besides so many other. So there was this desire to come close. And so our first challenge is to chant, to capture and to channel that enthusiasm for Torah study and for a commitment to halacha. How do I keep that connection? And I think that's number one. Number two, what becomes important is the sense of longing for shul. If Rabbi Kelman, you're telling me I haven't been to shul for 17 months and I can't wait to get back, halavai. Not talking about you, but halavai Jews with that same longing 17 months later should have the same longing to come to shul on Shabbos morning, not just 17 months later, but 17 weeks after the shul's open, or maybe for some 17 days after the shuls open, that we don't become cynical and we don't become used to the routine of of the keva, of the routine that going to shul has for many people. And so how do we harness and then harvest that enthusiasm that you are that you are talking about? And number three, there is a sense of commitment and of mesirat nefesh even that individuals had for these backyard minyanim. There are people who davened in weather. I mean, Toronto especially, the rain and the snow and the cold and the right. You come into shul and the air conditioner was a little bit off, and people complain they're not going to come because it's too hot and it's too cold and you can't this. But to daven outside, right? Or the sense of ownership that came because it was a small minyan and you required the people who came to be there and to be counted for the minyan or to participate and to contribute in many ways when it came to that minyan. How do we keep that when you're talking about a shul that has not just 10 people or 20 people or 50 people on a Shabbos morning, that has, and especially in Toronto, you have some very large shuls that has 500 people or 1,000 people on Shabbos morning. How do you maintain that same sense of commitment and that same sense of participation and that same sense of ownership? Fourth challenge, it's people have gotten used to a very different kind of davening. The singing is different. The length of the davening is different. The length of a Dvar Torah is different. And for good or for bad, people have become used to that type of davening. Shuls, and many shuls that have opened are learning that we can't just return to business as usual. We can't make the dozens of mishaberachs that they may have made before. You can't have some of the pomp and circumstance that you may have had in some of the larger shuls before. But how do you recreate this traditional Masorah community of prayer in a way that is meaningful, that is inspiring, and that may be more streamlined because of what people's needs are. So these are a number of things that have happened. Dr. Press Schwartz spoke about Zoom and Zoom for, if not for the students, at least for the parents. One of the interesting challenges that we found, opportunities that we found, and a friend of mine who happens to be on this call right now made the comment that it's difficult for him because of certain challenges that he has to get out at night to go to a shiur or to go to a lecture. And Zoom has been a wonderful opportunity for him because all he has to do is sign in. And he can go to a lecture. People who couldn't make the Shabbos that Torah in Motion had offered before for this program can tune in anywhere in the world and be part of what is going on. So there's an easy access, and I think that's going to continue. It's going to be challenging in two ways. Number one is, as I had mentioned before, creating that sense of the interpersonal interaction and the sense of community and of warmth is much more difficult over Zoom. That's challenge number one. And challenge number two for the rabbis is they're going to have to up their game because I'm no longer bound to the shir that my own rabbi is giving. If I don't like the chumash shir or the lecture or the daf yomi that my rabbi is giving, all I've got to do is sign on to Zoom somewhere. And there are thousands of opportunities of people who are maybe more creative or more dynamic or more insightful or who may not be, but who speak to me on my level and the types of things that interest me. So the kinat sofrim, the competition that will now exist for rabbis is going to cause them to up their game. And so I think I'm going way past the time that's allotted to me at the moment. But what we need to really think about is how we as shuls create a sense of meaning, of urgency, and of value to our buildings, to our communities, to the types of davening that we offer, the kind of classes that we offer. And the one other piece, and with this I'll end for right now, is that we learned during the pandemic that it was, that especially for rabbis, that it wasn't so much the shir that was being offered or the Dvar Torah or sermon that was being given on a Friday afternoon for people to tune into, but it was the one-on-one engagement with members of the community, with people who, because we were all shut-ins, people who were older and people who were younger and with kids or without kids or whatever it may have been. And how do we create, and how do rabbis maintain and communities maintain that sense of interpersonal engagement, which in many ways is much more valuable and much more transformative and much more important for a person's sense of participation and identification with a community that we may not have been sensitive to before. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments from our panelists?
I'd be happy to comment. I think what Rabbi Drach, that was a masterful presentation of a lot of the central issues that we're facing. I just want to add that I think from a woman's perspective, these issues are exacerbated for the most part. Many women experienced an extreme during a pandemic of being removed from the shul completely. The shul just carried on without the women being involved whatsoever, or without any efforts being made necessarily to engage women in the community. And then there are women who have the opposite experience, in particular, a lot of mothers of young children. This was something I heard a lot about here in Israel with Backyard Minyanim, where suddenly they felt closer to the action or more connected to the minyan than they had been previously, because there was a place their kids could play and it wasn't a problem, and they were in their backyard, but they were nearby, and that was something that they really felt a part of something. Or minyanim that suddenly allowed for women to give divrei Torah at the end of davening, which, because they were in a backyard setting, which was not a shul setting, and suddenly this seemed feasible, and this was a new way that they were including women. I've heard lots of reports of that. And I think another issue also, I can speak for myself, one of the biggest spiritual commitments we made as a family during Corona was our family Kabbalat Shabbat every week, which was really a high point for us. And going back to shul has really been a letdown from that perspective, meaning sometimes it's the people don't want the palm for the length. And sometimes you go back to shul and there's something about the ruchnias that you were able to find as davening as a family, which is not something that we usually do. That isn't finding a place anymore. So I think all of these values that you've identified are clearly the central values. One of the things I think is going to be critically important is for the process that addresses these values to be one that really is going to actively solicit the voices of all congregants, and especially women. I think unless the shuls are going to make I think it's going to be critically important for shuls to make an active effort to invite women's input in finding this way forward of, you know, Chadesh Yemeinu Kekedem. So it's not just Adam, it's also Chava, as it were.
In one of the backyard minyanim, a number of the women with whom I was speaking said what they loved about it is that they were much closer to the action. That in the shuls where they were just distanced because of the geography of the shul. And being able to see the Sefer Torah when it was being picked up, or feel close to be able to see what was happening in a way, was very, very important. And I agree, we need to figure out ways for that to continue.
I would like to pick up on something that Yosef Alachanovic said, Rabbi Drach, and push a little bit more, not because I disagree with anything that you've said. I think that the hiatus from institutional shul has highlighted some things that I have heard. I'm a high school teacher. I'm in close contact with a lot of my former students who are now young adults in their 20s. They are single modern Orthodox adults, or, you know, just married modern Orthodox adults. They're living on the Upper West Side of Manhattan or in Washington Heights in Manhattan. And here is something that they said to me. I heard from them a great deal before the pandemic. The sense of disenfranchisement when they moved from their campus tefillah communities, from their campus JLIC communities, where they were the leaders, they were the movers and shakers, they invited the speakers. And then they moved to a big legacy shul on the Upper West Side where they're member number 600 in a shul, and a whole bunch of people, 30 years their senior, with a lot more money than they have, go ahead of them on the line. And their lack of sense of investment in this, I personally had a front row seat to two different efforts by these young adults to get institutional orthodoxy to support other ways of engaging young adults. And in both cases, they ran into the obstacle that institutional orthodoxy did not want to do something that would be seen as undermining the legacy shuls and the legacy rabbanim. And the legacy shuls and rabbanim, for whom I have the greatest of respect, and for me personally, sort of, you know, shul davening is a very meaningful experience in a very meaningful place. They have a hard constraint. They have a mortgage. They have an air conditioning bill, as you said. They have electrical bills and salaries and all these kinds of things. And that means all the pomp you talked about, and the board, because they're the people writing the checks, and the hierarchy and everything else that comes with those fixed fixed cost of building salaries and everything else. And I don't want to be facile or naive about the Chadesh Yameinu Kekedem of engaging different kinds of people who want to engage in different kinds of ways in the same spaces. We are seeing in the non-Orthodox world people who are engaging in different kinds of ways by creating one version of or another of, you know, Unshul, whether it's Rabbi David Ingber's Romamu, whether it's Sharon Brous's Ikar in Los Angeles. And that is, let's just say straight, pretty threatening to a lot of institutional structures of Orthodoxy. At the same time, it's a real challenge that we need to meet because there are a lot of other people, besides Lumen, the Atzer HaLachanovic is talking about, a lot of our young adults who do not feel like the shuls we have are talking to them where they are, but the shuls we have are operating where they operate because of certain structural imperatives. And we're not gonna be able to hand wave around that. And I don't know how we're gonna solve for that. And I will say again, in the two cases that I know of personally, the young people's desire to innovate and create was stymied by the legacy institutions' need to focus on other things.
Can I respond? Is that
yes? I want you to respond. What do you mean? You must.
So yes, and I think it depends on the legacy shul. There are many shuls. Look, I was in the pulpit for 22 years. When I left the pulpit, I came to a different community, and I was not the rabbi of the shul. I was a balabas. And my wife and I, at the time when we moved in, said we'll be very supportive. We'll sit in the back row, and we're not going to get involved. But being who I am, I had some ideas. And I approached the leadership of my new community a couple of times, saying, having a person who had had 22 years in the pulpit, another, and insight and other types of things, these are my suggestions. I was also ignored. So it's not just the young people that that aren't necessarily being listened to. There is a culture in some communities of leadership, and it's hard to break into that. And once those people are in leadership, they're the ones who are calling the shots for a whole host of reasons, many of which you outlined, Dr. Press-Schwartz, very, very well. But there are others that are different. And there are other large shuls. It's easier in a smaller shul, but there are many large shuls that I know that intentionally go out of their way to bring in younger people in there as committee chairs, as being responsible for programming, as doing other types of things. And I think one of the hopes that I have, and I think that this will address a little bit what Yoetzet Halacha Novik was talking about and what Dr. Press-Schwartz is talking about as well, is that people are, I think post-COVID, will be voting with their feet in ways that they didn't vote before the pandemic. And if they're not going to come back to the shul, they're not going to engage in the shul, people in this leadership structure are going to have to, if they're smart, figure out ways of engaging them. Otherwise, their seats are going to remain empty and their programs will remain unattended. If they begin to see that and they're smart enough, they will begin to bring these people in and engage them in ways that they haven't engaged before. One of the interesting proofs of that may be that one of the suggestions that I gave 10 years ago to the leadership of my present community that was ignored then was actually picked up in preparation for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur this year. And I think it was in direct response to the challenges that they're finding post-pandemic, where a number of the backyard minyanim could very well be the seeds of new shuls in town. And the leadership here in the established shul does not want to see that.
What was the advice you gave, if I may ask? I mean, what I'll say before, if you think I won't press you on that as much, but
no, I'm happy to. I don't know
how many, last year davening on Rosh Hashanah where I went, it was a little bit longer in the tent that I went, but the shul that out there, they had 2.25 hours. And I know another shul, 2.5 hours, 2 hours. And lots of people want a Rosh Hashanah davening of 2 hours, like you were alluding to that before. And it's going to be very interesting this year what's going to happen.
Right. I'll tell you, one of the things that I had suggested then, and which the shul is beginning to pick up on now, the shul is a large shul, and Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur has 7 different minyanim. The only difference between them is the space in which they find themselves. And for those of us that got stuck in the smaller spaces because we were newer in town, regardless of our age, got stuck with the less qualified Balei Tefillah. It was not a pleasant experience. And what I had suggested then was, rather than divide up the minyanim just by when people are signing up, every other year was a lottery, and the other years were by seniority. So it depends on the luck of the draw when you happen to be able to go in and purchase your tickets. That's where you got to choose what was available when you went to choose your seats. Have different minyanim. Here, have a chazan in one shul, because some people like a chazan. And this is not rocket science. And have a yeshiva style davening in a second one, and have more singing in the third one. The shorter davening or a longer davening, whatever it may be. And the powers that be insisted 10 years ago, no, everybody likes it exactly the way it is, right? All 600 families loved the shul. It was perfect. Now they're seeing that because people have choices, and that even this year with the shul open, there will continue to be backyard minyanim, even for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. They realize that they have to tailor the davening and create options for people, you know, and it's a, they're providing a service. And if they're not providing the right service of the service, then people are not going to come. So there's a greater responsiveness to the needs of people, and I think that hopefully will change the way these shuls are dealing with some of the women's issues and dealing with some of the issues of younger adults, etc.
I think it's really a broader issue here. I mean, I think there is, Dr. Schwartz mentioning there's sort of a cultural divide. The young people, you know, it's a different orthodoxy from the orthodoxy that I grew up in. I think, and their different needs. And the pandemic has allowed them to sort of not go to shul anymore. And I know I've been speaking to people, tell me, you know, their friends, they've used it as an excuse, especially young married couples. Some of them have little kids, you know, all of a sudden they can't go to shul anymore. And I that is a real challenge. And I don't know, I think all the points are correct. And I think, yes, engaging women, engaging young people, that's a real challenge. And I don't know that we have the answers 100%. And I think if it's a problem you were alluding to in the Orthodox world, it's gonna be a huge problem in the conservative and reform, because they're not limited. On Rosh Hashanah, I can go daven on Zoom, you know, in the fancy shuls on the Upper East Side. Well, I don't have to stick in the, you know, here. So that's a real challenge. I don't know if anyone wants to comment. I mean, you have been commenting on that, but that's, we're going to have to work hard. We're going to have to work hard to get people. Okay. If nobody has any comments, we'll move on to our next question.
I would just make mention that Reform and Conservative movement are reporting that they have greater participation, larger participation over Zoom in their services than they did before Zoom and then. And it could be that for them and for us as well, we have to redefine what success is and what engagement is with members of the community. And it's not just, when I was rabbi of the shul, I used to sit and count, you know, how many people were in the, you know, how many seats were filled on a Shabbos morning, right? And that was a reflection of success. But perhaps that's not our measure of success anymore. And it's a question of engagement and how we're engaging people. And if for a Reformed Jew participating over Zoom makes them more Jewishly engaged,
100%.
That's success.
For sure. I just, there's sort of an economic aspect. I can tell you here, you know, the community here in Toronto, it's a lot of large shuls, the conservative shuls. And, you know, the conservative shuls has its own issues. And they're talking in mergers, like how they're going to maintain these buildings when everything's on Zoom. And, you know, it's a little bit different in Orthodoxy, but we have that same issue too on another level. Okay, Rabbi Wiseman, since you had mentioned you can't do a get as much as you might try online, and I assume you can't do a Seder Kiddushin either, although that I don't know. Maybe Seder Kiddushin's a little bit different. I don't know. I'm not going to enter in the halakhic opinion here. But have you noticed a greater stress on families? Have you noticed a rise in divorce cases and issues? Because, you know, there have been articles in the secular press about this. What's your experience from the perspective of the
thing? Yeah, the conventional wisdom in the world at large is that COVID was a real, real stressor on families, being holed up in apartments and in houses for families that had their challenges to begin with. COVID only exacerbated those challenges. And the conventional wisdom is that's led to larger numbers of divorce. I can tell you at the Beth Din of America, our numbers in terms of new files of divorces is up about 11%, but I think there's too much noise to really attract, to say that there's some kind of causal relationship between COVID and increased divorce rates, at least the way we're seeing it. First of all, gittin typically, or often, sometimes at least, take place at the tail end of a divorce process. So I don't know that the uptick in gittin right now is necessarily attributed to domestic turbulence from COVID. Second of all, our numbers in 2020 were probably down a little, so our 2021 numbers are probably just catching up with the gittin that were left on the table in 2020. So, I don't know that I can necessarily point to higher divorce rates. I think also in the general press, people are saying that even though divorce rates might ultimately be higher as a result of COVID, divorce rates actually plummeted in 2020 because people were opting for the status quo during a time of great stress like COVID, and they kind of just stayed put. But who knows what 2021, 2022 will bring. So we'll see. Anecdotally, I could tell you that in the divorce cases that we do handle, and in the course of mediations that have taken place and Dine Torah that have taken place in divorce cases, COVID, comes up as a stressor, as something that's just woven into the stories that people tell about how stressful it was to be holed up in houses. I see Yoatzet Al-Khanovic shaking her head. I'm sure people like her and others in the field who deal with domestic situations on the ground can attest to the fact that COVID was no doubt a great stressor. And I'm sure that we'll see it in the long run in terms of divorce rates at the Beit Din. But that's what I would say as far as the Beit Din's handling of divorce cases. The area where COVID actually also reared its head in Beit Din jurisprudence was our handling of financial disputes. There were a handful of COVID-related Dine Torah on the business side, what we call the Makas Medina cases, situations where contracts were frustrated because of COVID, tuition disputes because schools were not providing the same services that they were contractually obligated to provide under tuition agreements. And so we saw a handful of interesting cases in that realm. On our blog and our website, Jewish Prudence, there's a series of articles that we produced during COVID talking about the halachos of Makas Medina of pandemics and how that affects contracts and halacha. So that was kind of an interesting area that we hadn't previously explored or hadn't really previously had to adjudicate that got played out in terms of COVID. Although even there, I would say the more remarkable aspect of that was how few cases had to ultimately be adjudicated in Beit Din. And I think that's kind of a testament to the fact that people pulled themselves together, even though they might've been frustrated by the lack of services being offered by their schools, because frankly, the schools were closed and you can't do as much on Zoom as you can do in person. Even though people had job layoffs and all sorts of Pesach programs canceled, all sorts of contractual disputes that might've arisen, they kind of worked it out amongst themselves for the most part. And it's not like we saw skyrocketing cases of Dine Torah where people were just at each other's throats litigating these kind of disputes in Beit Din. For the most part, I think people were smart about it and were kind about it and negotiated compromises, offered refunds where appropriate, came up with solutions on their own, maybe mediated locally their disputes rather than kind of up it to the level of Beit Din adjudication. So that was one observation I had about kind of the flow of cases during and in the aftermath of COVID.
Let's go from the gittin to getting married, kiddushin. We'll first talk about meeting, couples meeting via Zoom, getting engaged, etc. How it's not, we don't want to necessarily get the whole notion on the shidduch crisis, but how really has this new technologies impacted on people meeting and going out, etc. So if anybody can comment, otherwise I'm going to pick on Dr. Schwartz because I think she had a lot of experience dealing with young single people in Washington Heights. And maybe if I can ask you to start our discussion.
Okay, dating, like everything else, shut down in March of last year when people thought that it was going to go on a brief hiatus. And, when it's also hard now to put ourselves back in the mindset that we were in New York City in March of last year. It was absolutely terrifying. Nobody was interested in going to try to meet another person. And the indication of how scared people were was that even shidduch dating, which itself is motivated by a great deal of fear of, you know, being single, nevertheless came to a complete halt. And then as it became clear this was going to be a longer process, people dealt with it in different ways. In the writer wing world, they went back to, you know, sort of in-person dating more quickly. I know a couple that met and got married. They got married in person, but they met and did just about all of their dating over Zoom, and they live halfway around the world from each other. And I think that had in-person dating been an option, probably the young man in North America and the young woman in Australia would not have thought to meet each other because each one of them would have been trying to meet people on their respective continents. But once we open it up to Zoom, it's an analog to the, I can learn Torah from anyone, anywhere. I can go to a shiur with anyone, anywhere. I can date anyone, anywhere. Whether that's a good thing or not, I'm not sure. Whether that opens up a world of possibilities or just increases the sense of overwhelmedness, I don't know. But that certainly was something that we saw happen. As with many of these things, what's going to be really interesting to see, and I'll talk for a minute also not just about the process of dating, but actually getting married. Again, in the really terrifying moments of the spring of last year, there was a sense that everything was going to change. This was going to change the entire world, and nothing was going to go back to be the same. I wrote an article about how this might potentially upend the entire financial structure of the American modern Orthodox community, which is built on a certain kind of affluence and. Guess what? Here we are, whatever number exactly it is, 16, 17 months later, acknowledging the enormous loss and the trauma, the deaths and the sickness and the financial suffering that many people have experienced. By and large, if I look around our community, if you ask me what I think is happening, I think we're brushing ourselves off and going back to business the way it kind of was. And one indicator of this is that when weddings all got shut down and we went from, you know, 10 people in your backyard to, okay, maybe you could have 50 people in your backyard, there were a lot of people who said, there is something wholesome about this. And the 400 person weddings, and we can all talk about the financial burdens on families and the bringing people together who don't all want to have to schlep out on a work night anyway for, and maybe we can find a way as a community to cut down on the size of weddings, to celebrate with those people closest to us, to find other ways to share in each other's smachot without having to. So there's a lot of talk about this. And then I don't know what your experience is, but my experience is that most of the people I know who are getting married now are moving back towards standard weddings of the sort that they would have been doing pre-COVID. I am invited to one wedding at the end of July where they made a conscious choice that even though the COVID restrictions have been lifted, they're going to do a COVID style wedding of, you know, essentially 100 people invited to the wedding, and then other people invited afterwards to out in Lakewood, they would call Simchas Chasam Nakala, some kind of celebrating and dancing later, but not the full wedding, the full meal. But by and large, I think our community in this sense is maybe missing an opportunity for a reset that would be beneficial for a lot of reasons. Some of the missing might be the desperate desire for normalcy. You want to be able to have some marker of return to normal. You feel like you missed out last year and you'd like to be able to do it this year. There might be other reasons as well why we are ducking the opportunity for a reset. But I have to say, certainly when it comes to how we celebrate smachot and the costs of those, the cost in many ways of those celebrations, what seemed to me a year plus ago to be an obvious place for a comprehensive top to bottom re-envisioning mostly doesn't seem to be happening.
I can just say, you know, I used to say before COVID hit that I hope, please God, when I marry off my children, I can have we don't have to spend $100,000 and we can have a smaller wedding. And I guess it came true. Baruch Hashem, we made a wedding during COVID, 22 people in our backyard. And, you know, and there was a certain beauty and intimacy. And I think we do have to find the middle ground. And I totally agree. We've lost that. Going back to 400 people weddings is not something we'd like. It hasn't happened in Toronto yet, just because our restrictions are, as far as I know, it hasn't happened, unless there are things going on, you know, that I don't know about, which probably is happening. But yes, that is the economics. I guess I unfortunately agree with you. We're back to sort of normal, despite everything that Rabbi Drach is saying and hoping for. I don't know the Chadesh Yemenu Kekedem. And if somebody wants to comment on that, anybody? Okay. All right. No, quiet. I don't know if that means you agree or you disagree or what, but Okay, Lori, if I may ask, you want to say something on that, Lori?
Not exactly on that point, but you know, when Revoicemen was speaking, I thought that just another element of the picture. So Revoicemen was talking about from the perspective of the Beit Din, and Gittin in particular, so on the Nida end of the picture, which is sort of like another area of halacha, which got sorely tested during the pandemic. And again, I think Rav Weissman's caution about drawing wider conclusions from just the cases that he's seeing without a proper statistical, you know, analysis is well taken. At the same time, what I think we saw, two things I just want to bring out. One is a tremendous amount of resilience. Nida is an area of halacha that couples or families, in a sense, because the couple is the seed of the family, are practicing in private without any kind of public scrutiny, or not practicing in private. It's between them really in a Kaddish Baruch Hu. And just based on the questions that we were getting, couples were certainly struggling, especially the whole other factor of the mikveh and the health concerns involved about going to the mikveh, to the point where there was a genuine legitimate worry that it was going to be, that could be life-threatening to immerse in the mikveh. This is something that got clarified. Thank God it got addressed. And over time we saw that with proper precautions taken, there didn't have to be that level of fear. And at the same time that the couples continued to persist in their adherence to this halacha was something that was very inspiring over the course of the pandemic and spoke to the resilience of the Jewish family as well. Another side of this, which I think is interesting, is the way that halacha entered the public sphere around Nida issues. A lot of rulings that ordinarily would be given on a case-by-case exceptional basis became commonplaces that were disseminated widely. I'm thinking, for example, in some communities, let's say with curfews, permission to immerse during the day. Generally speaking, this would be during the eighth day in most cases, but still it's something that comes up halachically, and generally it's really dealt with on a case-by-case basis. And here an entire community might be given that instruction. The positive of that is that I think a lot of couples were able to see in a different way the extent to which halacha is not just black and white, but is really nuanced and can handle the complexities of even a crisis situation. The downside or the complication of this is, moving forward, how does one assimilate the idea that something would have been permitted in an exceptional circumstance, but cases that come up day to day have to go back to sort of this more individual scrutiny. And that's something that I think is still really being worked out. So then there are positive outcomes of this. I think in the mikveh, for example, women have become more assertive. It's at least my impression that women have become more assertive, and perhaps mikvehs have become more cautious about assuming who's taking responsibility for the conditions of a woman's immersion. Is the attendant in the room? Does she ask permission before checking the woman? Something like that. And that's a positive. And on the other hand, I've also seen, I don't know if it's necessarily on the other hand, this is positives as well. I've seen women be much more assertive about asking for special halachic consideration in cases that I think previously they might not have thought to ask about, which can be wonderful. But sometimes it can also be complicated because in general, it's a whole other conversation. In general, we have to work on our halachic education so that what it means, or where halacha coming from a place of nuance or complexity, or being able to address the individual, how to understand how that works within the broader system, is something that we still have to do a lot more with public education, so that people can see how to move forward. And I guess that touches on some of the shul issues that Rabbi Drash was talking on as well.
Can I say
something? Akasha, yes. Go ahead.
First of all, Yotzer Alechanovic, I really, really want to thank you for raising this. We've now twice in this conversation, really important issues that affect women in the firm community that you've elevated into the conversation. I think it's really important globally as we think about resetting after COVID and everything else not to treat the issues of women in the FRM community as this kind of side issue that women bring up. But since women are half of the FRM community, women in the Orthodox community and the concerns that affect women in the Orthodox community should be front and center communal issues for discussion, raised and thought about by everybody. My experience in discussions, and I'm Nadia Yotzer Halacha, I'm a high school teacher who's in touch with former students. That's all that I am. My experience of talking to former students about this was somewhat different and dovetailed to what you said at the end about people who struggled with, and women in particular, who struggled with when they got the hard halachic no. Not the exceptions, not that you can go during the day or this or that, but women who said, I'm terrified to go to mikvah and I want some way of resuming my marital relationship and there's got to be something you can do for me. And Postkim said, no, there isn't. Until you go to mikvah, you cannot resume a sexual relationship with your husband. I actually ended up in a long conversation on Twitter about this with a former student on Erev Pesach of 2020, when I probably had better things to be doing than engaging, but it became a really long and interesting and fruitful conversation in which a generation of young modern Orthodox people who've been raised that modern Orthodoxy means both and. They can have the best of Torah observance and the best of the contemporary world, and they can get a great education in one of our fantastic modern Orthodox high schools, and they can go to a great undergraduate college, and a great professional career, and a meaningful religious life, and they can have it all. And then they run into the brick wall of like, just no. You cannot resume your sexual relationship with your spouse without going to mikvah. And if you're afraid to go to mikvah, that leaves you with, you know, only the options it leaves you with, and that's it. And it was really a dislocating kind of thing and a challenging kind of thing. Probably needed more working through than it got. Definitely speaks, as you said, to the kind of halachic education that's happening in our schools and in our families, but raised real issues in which, like, you know, it's all great as long as it's all great. But when you get that really tough no, how to assimilate and manage that. And that was also an experience that women and couples had with mikvah during COVID.
I would also add, I think that's a challenge. I think that's a challenge that we have as educators in the modern Orthodox community, because we're not always willing to go in that direction because we're selling commitment, and and we want to attract commitment, and that those are difficult conversations to have. But one of the interesting challenges, I think, if you look, there were many shilas that were asked during COVID, and many of the poskim of the modern Orthodox world really stepped up to the challenge, and were able to provide kulas, leniencies, and guidance in ways that were sometimes shocking and sometimes inspiring. And they really put themselves out there. One of the concerns that they had and that we had in conversations at the time is what happens when it's no longer a shad hadchak, it's no longer an emergency situation. And the answer has to be, as Yoetzet Halacha Novik was talking about, we're going more back to the way things were and to what the halacha consensus was without a shad hadchak, without an emergency situation. And what is, and so, for example, before last Pesach, the first Pesach, I think, was a 3-day yontif, and we came out with a statement with regard to rabbis and family members and friends keeping their telephones open, because if there were people with mental health issues and depression and suicidal ideation, we needed to be there for them. When we revisited that situation a year later, the answer was not the same. And when we revisit questions a year and a half later, the answer is not always the same. And I think there's a tension there. Part of the tension is, but when it's not a shat adchak, then we have to take into consideration other opinions and more and stricter opinions. But I think there's also a fear that we'll be, as halachic leaders, viewed incorrectly, and that we'll be seen as being too lenient and being whatever it may be, and so that we may see a trend, at least in the short term, towards stricter applications and of the law, and decisions being made, so as not to be seen as being overly lenient. And I think that one of the things that it becomes very important, and Yotzer Halacha Novik was referring to this, is that many shilas need to be answered on an individual basis. And their rabbis and halachic advisors have the ability to be more nuanced when their decisions are not being being presented to the public at large, and therefore being scrutinized by large numbers of people. And we need to figure out ways of moving forward that are sensitive to the needs of the individuals, to where they are in their halachic commitment, to where they are in their commitment to orthodoxy in general, of to what the situation happens to be. And it's not always a simple matter, especially in today's age when things are on Zoom and on the internet and shared so wide and shared so widely.
I want to say something in response to that, because Rabbi Drach raises something really important, which I was thinking of as we had this conversation, as he spoke about people leaving their phone lines open, and then as a result of a direct communication that somebody just sent me on Zoom. Part of the issue that was raised to me, and this was raised to me, I'll tell you who raised it to me, someone in our community who was a Jew by choice. She converted to Judaism. And she said to me this year, she meant Pesach of 2020, everyone's acting like it's an emergency and a crisis that individuals are spending the starim alone. Oh no, what are we going to do for the individuals who have to make starim alone? She said, I, as a Jew by choice, who don't have Jewish family, have had to make starim and other yamim tovim alone before. Other people have found themselves having to make yamim tovim alone before. Why was that not a crisis and an emergency that the community had to mobilize its halachic creativity to address? That was fine, because we were the people, you know, in the community who aren't seen as much or noticed as much. So whose pain gets elevated to the level of a communal crisis? And it is, of course, true, again, as somebody just messaged me privately, but it is still worth noting and saying that the discomfort in intimate relationships of a halachically married couple gets elevated to the level of a communal crisis that needs addressing. And there are plenty of other people within the Orthodox community, that's LGBTQ Orthodox Jews, that might be Orthodox Jews who aren't married, although I understand that straight and not married and gay are not the same thing. But I just want to name different people for whom these questions play out differently halachically, and who might say, why is this group of people's now halachic challenge or problem elevated to the level of a communal crisis, when other people's halachic challenge or problem in the same realm is not a communal crisis? And again, the first person I heard this from was a friend, a member of the community, who said, my starim alone were not a crisis. And now some people's starim alone are, let's have the rabbis leave their phones on. Because, and so one of the things where I really think there's an enormous amount of opportunity for Chadesh Shemenu Kekedem, for let's go back to the way things were, but let's go back better, let's look at what needed to be fixed, is let's see where there was pain or crises or people who were confronted by enormous halachic challenges that for one reason or another didn't get elevated to the top of the communal agenda. And maybe we need to be ready to elevate that to the communal agenda.
Rabbi Drach, you want to comment on that as the leader of?
She's right. I think it's, look, I think that it is happening, and it's happening more on individual community levels than it is on the larger level. And I think what was different at the beginning of COVID is that we were all in the same boat and we all had that same sensitivity. But we have people who are advocating for converts, and there are shuls and rabbis and shuls that make sure that everybody in their community is taken care of in Pesach and nobody should be alone. And there are rabbis who aren't sensitive to that. And there are rabbis who are sensitive to LGBTQ members in their community, and there are rabbis who aren't for a whole host of reasons. So I think, yes, we need to be talking about this more. It's harder to create that sense of panic and of crisis that we had at the beginning of COVID over these issues. Look, I fought this when I got involved in the area of domestic violence and child abuse for many, many years. And I couldn't understand why this wasn't on the top of everybody's agenda, and that we were all, you know, and that we didn't change our policies and do so many things, which just seemed so obvious to me. And realized at a certain point that, yes, it should have been high on the community agenda. The fact that it wasn't at that time meant that I had my, because I was sensitive to it, had my work cut out for me and kept on pushing and pushing. And I think we're certainly in a different place today than we were when I started getting involved in this probably 30 years ago. But we still have a long way to go. And so those of us who are fortunate enough and blessed enough to be sensitive to the issues that you're raising or to other issues, that's part of our avoda. And we need to push that forward and not let it rest. But I would say that it's not being ignored totally. It's just not being addressed enough.
Okay, the hour is getting late. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to ask each one of our wonderful panelists to briefly in a minute, minute and a half, maybe up to 2 minutes maximum, say the one item they'd like to see as a silver lining from COVID as we move forward. The number one change you'd like to see in our community. Okay, we'll start, Rabbi Wiseman, why don't we start with you?
Number one change. Look, I think the conversation over the last hour has been really, really edifying and really interesting. And the issues of sensitivity that have been highlighted in the last 10 or 15 minutes especially are especially important. If we could all leave COVID caring for the most vulnerable among us, remembering the sensitivity that was displayed by our poskim early on in the crisis, and if that results in comforting people, in lives saved, in our community being a more sensitive community, that would be a great silver lining. I think that's probably what I would say.
Okay, Yoetzet Halakha, Lori, and I really want to thank you again. You know, Lori lives in Efrat, and it is now 4:23 in the morning, and I knew when we did this that I could ask her. She's taught many, and I told Laser, I'm going to ask Laura if she wants to join the panel, and I'm convinced she's going to say yes. And really, I want to thank you really for getting up at 4 a.m. and hopefully you'll be a model for other people, but we won't do that. So please, Bakasha, the one thing, and maybe, you know, from an Israeli point of view, perhaps a little.
I don't think it's specifically Israeli. I want to second what Rav Weitzman said and what Dr. Schwartz and Rabbi Drash said, developing another level of sensitivity is absolutely one of the most important things we could do. I think I'd like to see a real cheshbon ha-nefesh. However that gets expressed, cheshbon ha-nefesh can mean different things to different people. But I guess the Israeli point of view is, I guess I felt this way about the elections also, right? So insanity is doing the same thing multiple times and expecting a different result. So, you know, you want to feel the thing that was so hard for me about the Israeli elections, probably more than anything else, which is feeling that we kept going into it and nothing seemed to be changing about the political discourse each round. Just there were sort of like musical chairs among the parties. And that's, I would like to see our communities say, okay, we need, not everything is obvious. I think more than that, let's really, what does cheshbon ha-nefesh mean? It means let's look deeply on an individual level. In what ways was I appropriately looking out for myself, my family, and shaping things differently than I had when community was working the way it had been working? Shani latzmi ma'ani. What can I contribute? What are my expectations? In what way was I let down by the community? That's also, I think, a real, it has to be part of the conversation. We have to be able to put that out there as well. But in what cases do I want to help the community rise up? So that's what I really want to see. I want to see more conversations like this. And I want to see conversations like this, not just taking place among rabbis and doctors. I want to see conversations like this taking place among all of us. And I would like to see them translate into, if possible, real change. Real change, you know, starts internally. Just that moment where we say, I learned something from this. Life and death were at stake. Nothing could be taken for granted. You know, we're moving into Tisha B'Av. What are we doing as a community to change and to grow? And not actively making those choices, I think, is a giant punt. It's missing the point.
Thank you. Rabbi Drach.
I agree with everything everybody said. It's not, there's not much that I think that perhaps it means, you know, we can't take anything for granted. We can't take our health for granted. We can't take our families for granted. We can't take our community structures for granted. We can't take, and that we have to actively, invest every day in creating the kind of life and the kind of community and the kind of Torah that we want, because it's very, very vulnerable. Tola eretz al blima. I mean, that's we'll be saying that during the Yamim Noraim. It's just hanging by a thread, and I don't mean to say this in a way to scare us, but it's a way to elevate us and to inspire us to respond in ways that we need to. And as you know, as was suggested, you know, who are the vulnerable? Who are the people that are on the margins? And in many ways, we all are on the margin in one aspect or another of our lives. Some more so than others. And that you know, we need to be sensitive to those things and as careful as we were when we were wearing masks. Some of us are still wearing masks on a regular basis. But the wearing of the mask wasn't foremost to protect ourselves, as we're told, but it's to protect other people. And how do we live in our spiritual worlds, in our Torah worlds, with the concern of wearing that mask in terms of living and being responsible for the other?
Dr. Schwartz, we'll give you the last word.
Thank you. I'll say, you know, a strong agree with what Rabbi Weissman said about taking that step back and thinking about who in our community might be as disadvantaged as the people in the middle of COVID and who needs thinking about. A strong agree with what Yotzer HaLacha Novik said about the Cheshbon HaNefesh. And in the spirit of what Rabbi Drach said about Chadei Shemein Kukedem, your institutions, and this is not about COVID, this is about post-COVID going back, your institutions and structures that we had because we had, and then we stopped them. And before we put them back, it's a chance to say, were those good? Did they work? Whom did they work for? I want to give you a super concrete example. I work in high school. We stopped enforcing attendance rules last year. We couldn't imagine kids trying to get to school. We had no idea what it'd be like trying to come to school in the middle of a pandemic. And we'll be like, oh, you're 2 minutes late for davening. Now you get detention. So we suspended all attendance enforcement last year. And now we're getting ready to go back to attendance enforcement. And we're asking ourselves, do we really want to go back to that? You're 2 minutes late for davening. That's one late. You get three lates. You get detention. You get too many detentions. You get in-school suspension. That would be like, you know, running that whole system. And it made sense. And we built it for a reason. And we want kids in davening. And there's a value of tefillah. And by the time you're 10 years down the line, that was the kind of accounting system we were running. And then we stepped another step back. And we said to ourselves, and what's the experience of tefillah like for kids? They come to school in the morning and we force them to go to davening. And for 35 or 40 minutes, a whole bunch of adults them the whole time and tell them they're doing things wrong and they're doing things badly and we're upset at them. Yeah, well, that's really engaging and that's going to really turn kids onto tefillah. And now that we stopped all of that, right, and we're backing up from everything and we're going back, what does it look like to put things back better? What does it look like not just to restart the attendance system that we suspended, but to put something else in place? Now that we're going to have more normal, we had tefillah in school last year, but in many ways it wasn't normal and it wasn't typical. Now they're going to have more normal tefillah. How do we go back to normal tefillah that isn't a whole bunch of adults shushkinning a whole bunch of kids and yelling at a whole bunch of kids for 35 minutes? Because what kind of an impact does that have on kids? And so if there's going to be any kind of silver lining, again, without minimizing at all the enormous suffering and loss and death and pain, it's going to be an enormous pause on a lot of things. And then not just turning them back on again, but stopping and thinking about them before we do.
Okay, thank you. I really want to thank all of you for a wonderful discussion and much, much food for thought. And for joining really to, you know, ending. We've had a wonderful day of learning. I want to thank all our speakers, all our participants, especially that's what allows us to have these sessions. And we look forward to learning. And hopefully we will take some of this to heart and, you know, discuss it and give advice to our own shuls and our own communities and be more sensitive. And thank you very much. And yashar koach. Okay. Just a few announcements in terms of the CME credits. Those who are interested in CME credits, fill out the form, please, on the Torah Motion website. A lot of people have been asking, please God, the recordings will be posted within a day or two. I don't know exactly how long. Normally there, I always say within a day. This might take a little longer, more involved. And we look forward to learning with you tomorrow. Back to the Torah Motion, our Zoom schedule at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Shira Mervis, Rabbanit Shira Mervis, will be beginning a five-part series on rabbis from the Islamic world. Tomorrow on Rav Uziel, the first Sephardic Chief Rabbi of Israel. That is followed at 12:15 by Rabbi Alex Israel speaking on Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, continuing his wonderful series on each week, a different book. Tuesday, Rachel Sharansky. Gidansger continues his series on kings, storytellings, and kings. Wednesday, Marty Lection is back on Pshat, Rush, and Halacha at 11 a.m., followed by Sefer Yirmiyahu with Simi Peters at 11. Moshe Sokolov on the Haftorah of the Week at 8 o'clock, a regular shir. Thursday morning, Shuli Mishkin, 11 a.m., is giving her last of her series on tours of Israel. Our Parsha Shir at night this week, Rachel Slutsky is giving, that's 8:30 on Friday night. On Thursday night, my Shir for Kevot at 9:30. And next Sunday from 11 a.m. through 7:15 p.m., without a break in the afternoon, our Tisha B'Av program, Shuli Mishkin, Rabbi Liebtag, Rabbi Strachler, Chaim Strachler, myself, Dr. Tamara Spitz, Natty Helfgott, Rabbi Natty Helfgott, Dr. Sokolow, and Jeff Weissman. So we have 8 speakers to keep you busy so you won't be hungry on Tisha B'Av. We can hopefully have an inspiring day. So that's a little bit upcoming, and we hope to learn with you. And I appreciate the speakers listening to all these announcements, you know, for staying on board. And we look forward to learning with everybody, and everybody should be well. And I hope you had an inspiring day and a meaningful day. And Laila Tov to everybody. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you, Laser, of course, for all his work. He let me do the last session, but he handled everything like prior. I want to thank him, of course, and thank Ilana and Shayna and all the people behind the scenes. Laila Tov.